95% of the properties in Barbuda were damaged. It is absolutely heart-wrenching.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1. In Palenville, New York on 102.9 WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. In New Orleans on 102.3 WHIV. In Washington, D.C. on 105.5 FM. And Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com if she has not yet evacuated Florida, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up, after 10 Republican states had sued the Obama and then the Trump administration to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. Now that the Trump administration has announced this week that they were, in fact, ending DACA, some 15 Democratic states are suing the Trump administration to reinstate it. We will speak with an attorney from the National Immigration Law Center about that lawsuit just filed on Wednesday shortly. Also, a little bit later in the show, Desi Doyen will be here with the Green News Report. Hello, Desi.
Hello.
We've got three hurricanes and a tropical storm now following Harvey. Three hurricanes and tropical storm in the Atlantic after Harvey. And as well, we've got record heat and wildfires in the West. And with all eyes now on the Caribbean and Florida with Hurricane Irma, hopefully we'll have some more details on the man-made ecological disaster in Houston that you've been looking into as well.
Yeah, it's not great.
That, of course, thanks to the Texas petrochemical industry and their very, the very industry-friendly laws that have now allowed companies to legally dump tons of toxic chemicals into the air and water amidst damage and flooding from Harvey. But from Harvey to Irma, reports of fatalities and widespread damage today in the northern Caribbean islands has begun to emerge late last night after Hurricane Irma, one of the most powerful storms ever recorded in the Atlantic, blasted through some of these island nations with devastating winds and rain. Barbuda right now is literally a rubble, said Prime Minister Gaston Brown of Antigua and Barbuda during an interview. He said the entire housing stock, was damaged. He said after visiting the island of 1,800 people, it is just a total devastation, he says. He spoke with CNN late on Wednesday night.
It was heart-wrenching, absolutely devastating. I have never seen any such destruction on a per capita basis compared to what I saw in Barbuda this afternoon. 95% of the properties in Barbuda were damaged. The infrastructure was damaged, all of the institutions, the lone hospital, the schools. It is absolutely heart-wrenching.
Irma destroyed, that was the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, Gaston Brown. Irma destroyed government buildings, tore roofs from houses, left islands without power or communication. Prime Minister Brown said there currently is no water or phone service for Barbuda residents. Communication was disrupted after winds snapped a cell tower in two on the island. Irma damaged Barbuda's lone airport, which will now force officials to ferry supplies to the tiny island by boat and helicopter from Antigua. Charles Fernandez, the Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade for Antigua and Barbuda, said the destruction there was, quote, upwards of 90%. So 90%, 95%, just devastation from this storm. At least two people died and two others were seriously injured on St. Bart's and St. Martin, according to the French Overseas Affairs Minister. Those islands are French overseas
protectorates,
collectivities, I think I've seen them referred to as. The French Interior Minister told reporters that in terms of material damage, the four strongest buildings on the island of St. Martin have been destroyed, which means that weaker structures have likely been either damaged or completely destroyed. Dan Gibbs, chair of a council on St. Martin, told Radio Caribbean International that it is an enormous disaster. He said, "I am in shock." One homeowner said that his home, which has a concrete roof and hurricane shutters, was spared, but many other homes suffered damage. He said, "Utility poles are down everywhere. There's no power, no public water." He said, "From my balcony alone, I count at least 24 homes and apartment buildings with either partial or entire roofs missing."
Yeah, and on the Dutch side of St. Martin, which is called Sint Maarten, one of the tourists said, "It's like someone with a lawnmower from the sky has gone over the island."
Stripped
it clean.
The firehouse in St. Bart's was under a meter of water that they're out of service, according to an update posted on Twitter. Firefighters were taking shelter themselves in an upstairs room after slamming St. Martin, Anguilla, and St. Kitts and Nevis.
Nevis.
The storm is now moving or has been moving near the British Virgin Islands and northern U.S. Virgin Islands. As we go to air, we're just getting word from AP of catastrophic damage in the U.S. Virgin Islands, with at least three people dead there so far. Forecasters warn that Irma's likely path, with maximum sustained winds of 185 miles per hour, which is above the 157 mile per hour threshold for a Category 5. It's well above that. That the path is now near the Turks and Caicos Islands today, is expected to pass just north of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, bringing hurricane force winds to northern sections of that island, causing mudslides and flooding most likely. In the Bahamas, emergency evacuations have been ordered for six southern islands. But where can these folks evacuate to, frankly, on these tiny islands? I mean, at least in places like Florida, which is being targeted by this terrible storm on Friday and into the weekend, folks at least have somewhere to go if they can get out.
Yeah, they can drive inland, for example, but not on these islands. On these islands, they are literally trapped if they can't get that last flight out.
It must be absolutely horrifying.
Oh, it's absolutely terrifying. Irma skirted Puerto Rico on Wednesday night, and right now, officials say that there are more than a million people without power. Now, that's a problem not just because electricity is nice and useful to have.
Yes.
It's good for hospitals. It's a necessity for them to get communications out. It's also a necessity for sanitation, for keeping the water running. And right now, they have major sanitation issues that they are talking about across the Caribbean, with the higher risk now of waterborne diseases, because there's a lack of clean drinking water. There's a contaminated of the water supply. And so right now, it's really difficult. On Thursday morning, the Puerto Rico governor, Ricardo Rosselló, said officials were beginning the arduous task of assessing damage to the island and bringing back electricity. He also warned that the weather is not over. He said that there's flash flooding to be concerned with. Additional rain is expected to come on Saturday.
Puerto Rico may have skirted the worst of this, but it's not over.
It's a very mountainous state. Yep. That means that all of that rain, and it's expected to have even more rain now, is going to cause flash flooding. So right now there are the National Hurricane Center says that the storm surge is also likely to cause life-threatening surf and rip current conditions, and those are also expected to come to basically all of the islands and Florida that are in the path of Irma heading this way. So it's a very bad situation. One of the things that really shocked me was specifically the Prime Minister of Barbuda said that for their island, which you mentioned, is only about 1,800 full-time year-round residents. Mm-hmm. He said that the damage he's estimating will be about $100 million to rebuild. And that's just for little Barbuda.
For a little tiny island, yes. Imagine how the coast of Florida, Georgia, North and South Carolina, which are now in line in the path of Irma, according to the forecasters. Meteorologists say that Irma could strike the Miami area by early Sunday, yep. I think, and then rake the entire length of Florida's East Coast, pushing into Georgia and the Carolinas. Colorado State University meteorology professor Phil Klotzbach said, quote, "This thing is a buzzsaw. I don't see any way out of it." In other words, it's not just going to come in to hit Florida and then break up and be done, or hit Miami and be done. This thing could continue all the way up the coast.
Yeah, with the hot ocean temperatures out in the Atlantic, this is how this hurricane continues to gather fuel to keep going.
Klotzbach said that this is only the second time on Earth since satellites started tracking these storms about 40 years ago that one has maintained 185 mile per hour winds for more than 24 hours.
That's unheard of. That hasn't happened.
It happened once. Apparently, there was one other time. That was it. It doesn't generally happen, though.
Right.
University of Miami hurricane researcher Brian McNulty said it could easily prove to be the costliest storm in U.S. history. And that's after many have been saying over the past week that Harvey would be the most costliest storm ever. Remember Harvey? Remember?
God.
That was just last week.
Yeah.
By the way, Trump's exclusive Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach is apparently straight in the path right now of the storm. Weather Underground's Jeff Masters said that if the storm goes up the Gold Coast, like the current models are saying, then the Gold Coast is going to become the Mud Coast. He said that includes Mar-a-Lago. Now, mind you, Mar-a-Lago has been there, I think, since like the 30s or something. It's actually fortified against these types of storms, or at least the type of storms that generally hit Florida. Whether it's up to 185 mile per hour winds, however, that's another question. Building codes were enforced more stringently in Miami after Hurricane Andrew in
1992? 1992, yes.
Which was, I think, the last hurricane of this strength to hit Florida. The population, however, has grown like crazy since then, and coastal development has continued, and as AP notes, climate change has become more pronounced. Also, housing constructed in Florida under the 2001 rules, all of this population growth and development under the 2001 rules, it's built to withstand just a Category 3 hurricane.
Oh, dear.
Or winds up to 129 miles per hour. That, according to FEMA agency director Brock Long. And this thing right now, while it's at 175, 185 miles per hour, I think it's going to go down to a Category 4 when it strikes Florida, if it strikes Florida. Down to a Category 4, but still that would be well above the 129 miles per hour Category 3.
And this is where policy responses to natural disasters really, really matter. When Florida was setting those building codes and deciding, oh, you know, we just had a Category 5, but let's go ahead and make those building codes only to Category 3. That was a policy choice, and that means that there are going to be a lot of people who, if Florida gets a direct hit and Irma is a Category 4, then there are a lot of people whose buildings will not be able to withstand that, who will have a lot of damage that was preventable.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people are going to say, well, why did we do that when we get the hurricanes that are Category 5? Why did we only require Category 3? Well, the construction lobby puts a lot of money into politics. They have a lot of sway in places like Florida. We'll see. God forbid we end up now paying the price for that.
Yeah, it would be nice not to have to test that.
All right, quick break here before we get to our our guest. Let me lighten things up a little bit before we get to our guest, because I find this story kind of funny. Russian President Vladimir Putin joked on Thursday that American Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had, quote, fallen in with the wrong crowd since he was awarded Russia's Order of Friendship Award back in 2013. Tillerson had served as the CEO of ExxonMobil. Since we're sort of talking about all of this ties back to the petroleum, to the fossil fuel industry. So,
because it does.
Yeah, I know it does. And so he was the CEO of ExxonMobil, of course, for 10 years before he accepted Trump's appointment as Secretary of State. He had extensive business experience in Russia over the past three decades. And so he was given the Order of Friendship Award, according to the Kremlin, for his, quote, big contribution to developing cooperation in the energy sector. Specifically, he had received it after Exxon expanded a deal with the majority Russian government-owned energy company Rosneft, a huge deal, like a $3 billion deal that I believe is still blocked due to sanctions that the U.S. under Barack Obama had instituted against Russia. Well, on Thursday, this according to the translation from Reuters, Putin had joked to a U.S. citizen at an economic forum in Vladivostok that that he regretted giving Tillerson the award. He said, "We awarded your compatriot, Mr. Tillerson, the award of the Order of Friendship, but he seems to have fallen in with the wrong company and to be steering in the other direction," he said. Adding, quote, "I hope that the wind of cooperation, friendship, and reciprocity will eventually put him on the right path."
Oh, my.
Reuters reports that the comment was met with cheers from the crowd. All right, one more before we get to our break here. Former Mexican President Vicente Fox is speaking out very, very strongly against President Trump for his decision to end the DACA program. He tweeted, and actually the tweet, I think, is stronger than the video, but he tweeted a video with a few comments, and within the tweet itself, he said, "Donald Trump canceled the future of 800,000 kids who are the cornerstone of America." And he added, he didn't even have the balls to say it himself.
Wow.
"Trump, you have failed America. Canceling DACA. It is the worst action you have ever done against the ones that cannot defend themselves. This measure is cruel and heartless. You're canceling the future of 800,000 children and young people. You are so mistaken. The future of any country is the minorities, which will be majorities in a few years. You cannot stop the change, the progress, the future of that great nation. I hope your grandsons never be in this terrible situation."
Wow.
That was former Mexican President Vicente Fox slamming Donald Trump after the announcement that some 800,000 kids, children of immigrants who came here through no fault of their own, may now be deported if Congress doesn't come up with some sort of legislation in the next 6 months to head things off, or if Donald Trump doesn't change his mind as he does. Well, now a new lawsuit may help Donald Trump change his mind. We'll take a quick break here and come back and talk about the lawsuits actually now being filed against the Trump administration to reinstate DACA. So many lawsuits against this administration, so little time. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
Unfurled,
yep.
They're coming to America.
Yeah. Remember when we used to play that song at 4th of July celebrations? We were proud of that then. We used to play that. You don't hear that anymore on the 4th of July. Yeah, there was a moment in time, many years in fact, when the U.S. was actually proud to be a nation of immigrants. I'm old enough to remember it very well. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. After the Trump administration announced on Tuesday that they were ending President Barack Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, President Donald Trump on Thursday said that young undocumented immigrants currently protected by DACA had, quote, nothing to worry about during the 6 months before the program's protections ended. In a tweet that was apparently a response to a request from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who is currently enjoying the fact that Trump agreed with congressional Democrats on a short-term deal to fund the government through the end of the year. Don't get too excited, Nancy. He will stab you and the Democrats again very soon. In a tweet in response to a request from Pelosi to DACA recipients, Trump said, "For all those that are concerned about your status during the six-month period, you have nothing to worry about. No action," said Trump. Feel better? Yeah, you've got a full 6 months before we begin to deport you, apparently, unless Congress takes some sort of legislative action, and Trump is in the mood to sign that action. Nothing to worry about, really? I wonder if I had tweeted to Trump, "Hey, you and your family members may be indicted and sent to jail, but probably not for 6 months or so, so you have nothing to worry about." You suppose that would put him and his family at ease? Of course, on Tuesday, Trump formally ended DACA, the program that allowed nearly 1 million undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to apply for work permits, giving them the ability to live out of the shadows without immediate fear of deportation. Trump's executive action was a reversal of President Obama's executive action, which 10 Republican attorneys general had threatened to sue to end, and which Trump's attorney general, Jeff Sessions, described as an unlawful executive overreach carried out by the previous president. The program ceased accepting new applications on Wednesday. Holders of current DACA permits expiring before March of 2018 can apply for a 2-year extension, but they must do so before October 5 of this year, barely 30 days to do that. Those with permits expiring after March 5 of next year will be eligible for deportation as soon as the following day. The new Trump policy has been roundly criticized from almost all quarters on the left and even in many places on the right, as well as by religious organizations and, of course, immigration advocates. In a statement released by the National Immigration Law Center, vowing to fight alongside immigrant youth and their allies, the center's executive director, Marielena Hinsopier, said, "This is a defining moment for our country. We are being called upon to choose which side of history we are on. Are we going to stand with young people who have grown up in our country and are striving to achieve their dreams, or are we going to allow policymakers to erect barriers that block youth from contributing their best to this country, which is their home?" President Trump allowed DACA to continue for his first 7 months in office, she says. He told young immigrant people that they could rest easy and not fear deportation. But now Trump has bowed to his anti-immigrant advisors and base, putting politics above people, hate above reason. The National Immigration Law Center went on to say this is a morally bankrupt choice. Trump's decision to pull the rug out from under nearly 1 million young people who are contributing to their communities across the country will only serve to destabilize these young people, their families, and their communities. DACA, she writes, DACA applicants relied on a promise by the federal government to allow them to live and work without fear of being deported if they came forward, paid a fee, passed a background check, and were deemed eligible after meeting certain requirements. The National Immigration Law Center will vigorously defend their rights in the courtroom if necessary, should the government renege on that promise. Well, it looks as if the government is reneging on that promise. And now some 15 Democratic state attorneys general have filed suit against the Trump administration. According to the AP, 15 states and the District of Columbia sued the U.S. government on Wednesday to block President Trump's plan to end protection against deportation for young immigrants, who New York's attorney general labeled the best of America. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in Brooklyn, asks a judge to strike down as unconstitutional the president's action involving the DACA program. It called the move, quote, a culmination of President Trump's oft-stated commitments to punish and disparage people with Mexican roots. Joining us now to discuss the lawsuit, what it alleges, and its chances for success is the National Immigration Law Center's Myra Wachin. She is staff attorney and a Columbia Law Social Justice Fellow for the National Immigration Law Center, where she focuses on improving access to affordable health care coverage for uninsured immigrants. Prior to joining NILC, Myra worked at the Public Law Center's Immigration Unit and for Judge Denny Chin of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. She is herself a Salvadoran immigrant and a graduate of Columbia Law School. Myra Wachin, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Brad.
Great to have you here. Originally, we had, as I noted in that intro, 10 states, all Republican states, suing to end DACA. Now we have 15 state attorney generals from Democratic states suing to reinstate DACA. Both groups seem to be claiming that the actions, first by President Obama, now by President Trump, are unconstitutional. And I should say, I'm against Trump's reversal of DACA. I think it's cruel and inhumane and self-defeating and frankly harmful and expensive in many ways to the U.S. But that said, much as I believe that Obama had the constitutional and legal right to institute his executive order, doesn't Donald Trump similarly have that right to reverse it with his own executive order?
Well, Brad, then that's a great question, because this has been the crux of the argument on the states who previously sued to terminate the DACA program. Mm-hmm. Those original states, 10 states, who soon became 9 after the state of Tennessee decided to withdraw from its support. Those states indicated that because the Obama administration had issued the program DACA through executive action, it was part of executive overreach, and as a result, it was an unconstitutional. The fact is that any president has the authority to issue forms of deferred action, as did the Obama administration, and previous administrations have done so themselves. What we are alleging in our lawsuit is that even though creating the DACA program was an exercise of executive action, removing that program can be done whenever there's a longstanding policy in which individuals have relied. And this is, in fact, because one federal statute, the Administrative Procedure Act, prohibits any reversals of longstanding policies in which individuals have relied. And so DACA is a program that almost 800,000 individuals have benefited from. This program has enabled them to secure a job, to advance their educational goals, to obtain access to items such as a home or to purchase a car, different items that they wouldn't have been able to attain without the DACA program. This program has been in existence for now 5 years, and it was in place for about 7 months while the Trump administration, since the Trump administration took office. And throughout this time frame, individuals have constantly relied on a promise that they would be able to obtain temporary deferred action because of the DACA program, and the reversal of this policy without any adequate reason for doing so is a violation of federal law. And this is something that the 15 states as well as D.C. have agreed upon, and it's the basis for both the lawsuits on behalf of the states as well as the Martin Batalla Vidal lawsuit, which is a lawsuit that we brought forward on Tuesday immediately after the Trump administration announced its decision to terminate the program.
So at the crux of both of these lawsuits, your own and these 15 states, is the idea that Donald Trump may have, as president, the authority to take these actions, but he has to have some compelling governmental reason in order to do so?
That is correct. In order for the Trump administration to reverse this policy, they must have an adequate justified reason. Mm-hmm. However, when they issued their statement on Tuesday indicating that the program would be phasing out. There was no adequate justification. Instead, the government repeated erroneous statements indicating that these individuals are taking other people's jobs and making statements that aren't accurate. The government also relied on speculation of upcoming judicial decisions where there really hasn't been any decisions that have been issued on the legality of DACA. And so we believe that the fact that there is no adequate justification that was made before terminating the program is a violation of federal law.
The DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has announced that that it will give DACA information to immigration authorities if asked for that information. We've seen cases recently, and I think perhaps under the same legal argument that you're making here, Myra, that one of these lawsuits over funding of Obamacare, where the courts determined that a promise that had been made by the federal government, in that case, I think it was for payments to an insurance company, that the promise for that payment must not be withheld by a new administration, at least without a similar, you know, a compelling reason. That seems a very similar legal argument could be in play here. These were folks who followed the rules. They gave their information, names, addresses to the federal government. They paid taxes, etc. So is that a similar legal argument? And do any of these lawsuits actually try to block the Department of Homeland Security from giving that information to immigration authorities?
Yes, and this is actually a claim that's raised within the state's lawsuit. The states are claiming that the individuals, because they have provided information regarding both themselves and their relatives, this is all sensitive information which the individuals only provided because they relied on the DACA program's previous memo, which indicated that providing this this information would not result in any enforcement actions against them. Since the announcement was issued on Tuesday, the new memo and frequently asked questions indicates that any information that has been submitted through those applications may be made available to immigration enforcement agencies whenever that information is needed for a removal procedure or whenever someone is placed at the start of any removal procedures. And so as a result, information that almost 800,000 individuals submitted, not just about themselves, but about their loved ones as well, can be made available to enforcement agencies that could place them into removal proceedings. This is devastating. It's an unfortunate result of the announcement that came out on Tuesday. And so states are now claiming that because individuals relied on the administration in providing that information, and because the former administration did indicate that this information would remain confidential and it would not be shared, it is unconstitutional for the administration to now indicate that that information can be used in enforcement procedures.
I want to ask you about the administration's claims. Jeff Sessions, I noticed it wasn't Donald Trump who went out and made the announcement. He sent out Jeff Sessions to do it on Tuesday.
Right.
I want to ask you some more specifics about their claims. But as an immigrant yourself, a Salvadoran immigrant, what is your sense? What is the feeling among the immigrant community at this point following this announcement? Is there concern, fear, strength to stand up against this? What's your general sense of the community at this point?
I think it's a combination of the various different items you just listed. There's fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear in the fact that these individuals who will start phasing out of the DACA program starting March 6th can be picked up by immigration agencies and placed through removal procedures. These are individuals who have lived, many of them, for decades in the United States and who call the United States their home, that there's a fear as to what can happen to their relatives, fear as to what will happen to their employment opportunities. Will they be able to secure a job? Even though many of these individuals have worked hard for years, they've pursued advanced educational degrees and are now facing the reality that as of March 6th, many of them will no longer be able to be employed under federal regulations. There's a lot of uncertainty as to what will happen 6 months from now. As you mentioned earlier, The President Trump did issue a tweet stating that there will be some type of action in 6 months, but no one knows what that means. And the administration's previous inconsistent statements, first indicating to Dreamers that the administration would work with them and create a good program, and now revoking that program, suggests that we don't know what will happen to the DACA program itself, at least from going forward from the administration's standpoint. Right now they have reversed it, and whether they will take an alternative route 6 months from now is unclear. There's also a lot of concerns among family members because this announcement on Tuesday was devastating, not just to the 800,000 individuals who are directly affected, but also to all of their loved ones. Mm-hmm. We must remember that sometimes it may be the parent who is a DACA beneficiary and they have U.S. citizen children, or it might be a sibling that's in the status. And so the impact of this decision far surpasses the 800,000 people who are affected by it.
Yeah, and this is after Donald Trump had said previously, oh, no, we're not going to break up families. We're going to keep them together. Hard to know if he meant that he was going to keep them together by allowing them to stay here or throw out, you know, the entire family, including a lot of these kids who now have kids themselves, as you say, who are, in fact, American citizens. It also seems to me, Myra, that the administration has somewhat backed itself into a corner. While Trump has, you know, come out and said, well, we'll see, he'll revisit the issue after 6 months. Well, when they made this announcement, they said that that Obama's original executive order was unlawful, was unconstitutional. Well, if the Congress is unable to legislatively fix this and it goes back to the Trump administration to do something about this, wouldn't using his executive authority to once again defer or delay the deportation of these people, wouldn't that be similarly unlawful and unconstitutional as they had claimed Obama's order was?
And that's a difficult standing ground, because they have previously claimed that this creating the DACA program itself was an overreach of executive action. And so if the Trump administration were to consider reinstating the program and follow a similar protocol, it would essentially be doing what it claimed the Obama administration did so unconstitutionally. And so what the tweet may suggest, and what it appears it's happening within an administration who's gone through various challenges in the past 7 months, is that there's this constant back and forth between Congress and the White House as to who's going to take responsibility and who's going to legalize a program that has protected hundreds of thousands of individuals, mm-hmm. whom many, including Republican Congress members, believe should be allowed to remain in the United States.
It's been about 10 years, I think, since Congress, specifically Republicans in Congress, have failed to pass legislation to deal with this issue. Do you get any sense that suddenly Congress will be more likely to handle this problem now that a 6 month clock is ticking? What is your sense of that? Is Congress finally going to be able to pass something to put this problem behind us?
Well, I do believe that there's a glimmer, a small glimmer of hope in what occurred on Tuesday, in that subsequent to the announcement, individuals across the nation have sprung up and vocalized their support for the DACA program. Prior to Tuesday, many individuals did not even understand what DACA was. Now, as a result of the announcement, there's a large group of individuals who have been participating in rallies and marches across the U.S., voicing their support for the program. We do believe that Congress members themselves are supportive, and this is a program that has always had bipartisan support. We believe that the decision to end the program, which is ultimately providing this six-month window for Congress to find a solution, is going to ignite a fire that may not necessarily have been there in the past, simply because these individuals had some sort of protection. Mm. Now it is up to Congress to take action and to do what's right and ensure that these individuals don't lose out on the protections that they deserve to have.
Myra Joaquin, I've got just another minute or so here, but in speaking about this, in people suddenly, you mentioned that people are suddenly understanding what this program actually is and how important it is to so many people. It kind of reminds me of what happened when they were trying to kill the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Suddenly, a bunch of Americans who had been fed propaganda about these programs for so long finally understood what these programs really are, and you saw an uptick in support for Obamacare. I know your work at the NILC focuses on improving access to affordable health care coverage for uninsured immigrants. We've been talking on the show of late about how the Trump administration seems to be all but abandoning promotion and organization for the upcoming Obamacare enrollment period that begins in November, particularly in the Latino community. In your work on healthcare coverage issues with immigrants, have you noticed a specific change in communication or resources, et cetera, being made available to the community by this administration in comparison to the previous years under the Obama presidency?
So there's actually been less resources that have been made available under this administration to the Latino community. What we're witnessing instead is the need for local advocates and insurance providers to develop their own materials ever since November. And because of the rhetoric that was used throughout the campaign that was anti-immigrant and anti-Latino, many individuals began doubting whether they were able to access healthcare services despite being eligible to do so. I do want to emphasize that the Affordable Care Act has several restrictions in terms of who can access its services, and so only certain individuals in specific immigration categories, these are individuals who are lawfully present, and so they have a federal authorization to be in the U.S., are the ones who can access services under the Affordable Care Act. However, because of the constant fear that individuals might be targeted for immigration if they access any services that they weren't eligible for, many individuals stopped accessing healthcare services, stopped going to the doctor, started canceling appointments. Mm. And what we're seeing is an uptick in organizations who are developing materials to remind individuals that they continue to be eligible for these services. The laws have not changed. And instead, we want to remind everyone that any healthcare service for which they have been eligible prior to the Trump administration continues to be available to this date. Eligibility rules around those services have not changed, and so people should continue to access those necessary services.
Don't be afraid. You still have rights in this country, at least for a while longer, thanks in no small part to the National Immigration Law Center fighting for those rights. Myra Joaquin, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your work and NILC's work. People can get more information at NILC.org and on the Twitters at NILC_org. I think that's all the context there. Myra Joaquin, really appreciate you joining us here today, and don't be surprised or angry if we give you a call once the open enrollment period starts, just to follow up and see how things are going.
No, of course. Thank you so much, Brad, for having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you, Myra. Okay, a quick break, and we are back to Green News and the Green News Report. Updates on all of these hurricanes and tropical depressions right now in the Atlantic, and more of the fallout from Harvey, which continues. So all of that and more right here on the broadcast straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen, I know you've already got updates to the to our latest Green News Report, so let's get to it so we have some time for those updates.
I cannot stress this enough. Do not ignore evacuation orders.
After widespread devastation in the Caribbean, Hurricane Irma takes aim at the U.S. Hurricane Harvey leaves behind a man-made ecological disaster. Plus,
over 130 active large wildfires, 12,000 firefighters in the state of California.
Record heat waves and wildfires across the West, and FEMA is out of money.
All of those records and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
There's a new and seems to be record-breaking hurricane heading right toward Florida and Puerto Rico, and it looks like it could be something that will be not good.
It will be very not good.
Believe me, not good.
I believe you. For the first time, this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, the weather historians are reaching deep into the record books with now three different active hurricanes in the Atlantic and a tropical depression behind the third one. It's kind of amazing.
Yes, it's turning out to be a doozy of a hurricane season.
To say the least.
On the heels of Hurricane Harvey, the record-breaking Hurricane Irma made its first landfall early Wednesday morning on the tiny island of Barbuda as a powerful Category 5 and plowed across the Caribbean, causing widespread destruction, killing at least 13 people and pummeling Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is already grappling with a deep financial crisis, and officials warn it could take months to restore electricity to the U.S. island territory.
And I'm afraid it will take some time to actually get any kind of real death tolls from the devastation so far, because a lot of these tiny islands are, their communication is completely knocked out.
Hurricane Irma is the most powerful hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic Ocean, according to the National Hurricane Center. As we go to air, Irma remains on a collision course with the east coast of the U.S. The governors of Florida and South Carolina have declared states of emergency, and Florida Governor Rick Scott has ordered mandatory evacuations, warning residents to take Irma's threat seriously.
I cannot stress this enough. Do not ignore evacuation orders. Remember, we can rebuild your home, but we cannot rebuild your life. Do not sit and wait for this storm to come. It is extremely dangerous and deadly and will cause devastation. Get prepared right now.
Irma is the most powerful storm on the planet so far this year. It's fueled by heat energy from unusually warm ocean temperatures. Climate scientist Michael Mann told Climate Progress, quote, Irma certainly fits the pattern of increasingly strong hurricanes, precisely what studies have predicted we would see as a result of human-caused warming. Right behind Irma, Hurricane Jose has formed in the Atlantic. And in the southern Gulf of Mexico, Hurricane Katia is now threatening the Mexican state of Veracruz. That's three simultaneous hurricanes, a rare occurrence, all fueled by record warm ocean temperatures.
And then there's that tropical depression behind Jose. This just keeps going and going.
In Texas, economic losses wrought by Hurricane Harvey are estimated to be in the neighborhood of $200 billion, more than Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy combined. Harvey also left behind an ecological disaster. 13 Superfund sites in the Houston region were flooded. More than 1 million pounds of toxic pollution was released into the air and water from the refineries and chemical manufacturers that are clustered in the region. The toxic pollution releases are legal, a result of the fossil fuel and chemical industries successfully lobbying Texas and the EPA to weaken rules on toxic pollution and disclosure.
Apparently the message, please mess with Texas.
Simultaneously, out in the western U.S., an extreme heat wave obliterated all-time high temperature records in many cities over the Labor Day weekend, like San Francisco, which recorded its all-time highest temperature of 106 degrees. That heat wave intensified over 100 large active wildfires across the West, blanketing the Pacific Northwest region in smoke and ash and moving Washington State Governor Jay Inslee to declare a state of emergency. In Montana, campers were evacuated from Glacier National Park. In Oregon, more than 140 hikers were rescued from a wildfire in the Columbia River Gorge. And the city of Los Angeles was hit with the largest wildfire in the city's history. Because of the string of natural disasters this year, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has nearly depleted its budget for the year. Congress appears to be moving quickly to pass supplemental funding for FEMA and an $8 billion initial disaster aid package for victims of Hurricane Harvey. A handful of Republicans are still demanding budget cuts elsewhere to offset disaster aid, like they did when they attempted to block disaster funds for Superstorm Sandy. Climate scientists have warned for years that man-made global warming will bring more frequent and intense extreme weather events. Our cities were built for the last century's climate. It's long past time we start thinking about the next 100 years.
Long past indeed. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Now they're planning the crime of the century. Well, what will it be?
I think we know what the crime of the century was.
And
at
is.
At this point.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Is and will be. We've got some updates, speaking of the crime of the century, some updates since today's Green News Report on Jose?
Yes.
No way.
Yes, remember that. So that's the second hurricane following behind Hurricane Irma that's out in the open Atlantic right now. It's, of course, too early to tell its exact path, but the National Hurricane Center released an ominous bulletin on Thursday about Jose. It says, quote, Jose expected to become a major hurricane by Friday, watches issued for the northern Leeward Islands. Those are the ones that were just hit by Hurricane Irma. Jose is now a Category 2, and Antigua and Barbuda have issued a new hurricane watch. Barbuda.
So all of those, we sort of followed the path of Hurricane Irma at the first part of today's show as it's been going across through the Leeward Islands.
And across the Caribbean.
Caribbean towards Florida. Now this storm is right behind it, set to take the exact same path, hit those exact same island nations once again.
Right. Again, it's still too early to tell, but it's just sort of, you know.
Ominous, yeah.
It's very ominous. Okay, so now back to Harvey, Hurricane
yep.
Harvey and Houston. There's a new development now. A plume of benzene, toxic benzene, has been detected in the air over Houston by air monitors after four fossil fuel companies reported leaks of the highly toxic compound. Benzene damages the central nervous system. It increases the risk of cancer even from very brief exposures. And what we had been talking about in
you mentioned in the Green News Report that
yeah.
this is legal. It's not legal to release benzene, for Christ's
no,
sake.
No, it's not necessarily legal to release benzene, but the chemical industry and the fossil fuel industry lobbied the Obama administration, EPA, to revise their rules that now exempt companies from any limits about how much they can release when they're starting up and shutting down during what they call force majeure, which are, you know, acts of God events, weather events like Hurricane Harvey. So they weren't supposed to be able to do that. They were supposed to take extra precautions to prevent such toxic compounds from being released, but the Obama administration changed that rule after that aggressive lobbying.
Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, and so now also in the state of Texas, remember the Arkema chemical plant in Crosby, Texas?
Yes, the one that we were waiting. It was going to blow up no matter what. It was going to catch fire. These chemicals, they couldn't keep them refrigerated because the power was out, and then eventually they did, like,
yep.
eight different trailers
eight
blew
different
up
tanks
and caught
and
fire.
Trailers
yep.
blew up and caught fire. That has they had to allow it to burn itself out.
Mm-hmm.
So now a new lawsuit has been filed against the Arkema Chemical Company.
Good.
So based on the fact that only a few months ago, just as this little background here, in Texas, Arkema and its lobbying group got both Texas and the EPA to change rules that were designed to require chemical companies like Arkema to share information about what kind of chemicals are stored on site so that they can help out first responders. Now, this was a rule that came in after the West Texas fertilizer plant explosion, when all those first responders rushed in and 15 people were killed by that explosion because
yeah.
nobody knew what was on site.
So this required them to disclose what is on site to government officials, but not to the public?
Well, this was to everybody. It was
okay.
supposed to be a publicly available report. And then at that time, the Attorney General of Texas, Greg Abbott, who's now the governor,
yep.
he actually personally intervened to make those reports confidential so that the public can't get access and neither can first responders. So unfortunately, when those first responders were standing outside the Arkema chemical plant,
yep.
when those tanks exploded, reported. Remember, there was about 14 of them were sent to the hospital. Well, now one of those first responders has filed suit. He says that they should have been told what was there. They should have had any kind of information to let them know. He said all of them fell ill in the middle of the road after those tanks exploded. So they say that Arkema failed to provide them with that accurate information. So, you know, we'll see what happens from that lawsuit, but somebody is now reaching out and saying, stop it.
Good. Good. Sue the bastard. Sue Greg Abbott. Fine by me. All right. And one more item just in, because we haven't been the bearers of enough bad news today. Just breaking from AP, apparently Equifax, the credit monitoring service, says that a breach exposed Social Security numbers and other personal data from some 143 million Americans. Mm. The Atlanta-based company says criminals exploited a U.S. website application to access files between May and July of this year. Social Security numbers, birth dates, addresses, in some cases driver's licenses.
Oh, wow.
Were exposed, everything you would need to steal someone's identity. As well, credit card numbers for about 209,000 U.S. consumers were also accessed. So Social Security numbers for 143 million Americans, that's about
half the population.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And 200,000 consumer credit cards. And yet, don't worry, your local county registrar will be perfectly able to protect your vote on their voting machines. Equifax can't, but your county clerk will be able to do so. I got some thoughts on that, maybe for our next thrilling episode of the Bradcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Myra Huachin of the National Immigration Law Center, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, we hope you will follow and share us. I am simply The Brad Blog. You can also drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And as ever, my thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we try to do every day on your public airwaves. All right, until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.